Judy Blume is certainly best known for her influential novels turned classics, including Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, otherwise known as Sheila the Great, Forever, and Summer Sisters, just to name a few. They touched the lives of tens of millions of adults and children. For 55 years, her work has done something revolutionary, rewired the world's expectation of what literature for young people can be. It can be frank, it can be candid, earthy, and unafraid to show the messier sides of humanity. However, there is very little known about the real woman behind the persona of Judy Blume and the unlikely journey of her literary ascension. To change that, we welcome Mark Oppenheimer, a journalist and lifelong Blume fan. His new book is Judy Blume, A Life, which tells the story of Judy Blume. He had complete access to unpublished writings, private papers, and 100-plus interviews with Blume, along with her friends and associates, while writing the book. The result is revealing and captivating and often quite surprising. Again, it is Judy Blume, A Life by Mark Oppenheimer. Mark will be at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on the 24th of March, that's Tuesday, at 7 p.m., and he joins us on the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
It's really good to be talking with you. As I said, I'm a fan of the show, and it's an honor to be making my debut.
Very nice to have you on the program, and we welcome you. And at what point did you decide that this was somebody that you wanted to tackle? Obviously, when you make a decision like this, it's a big decision because you're going to be with this person for a long time.
Well, it is funny. I mean, I say that. So I was a high school runner, not a particularly distinguished one, but I always say every runner has their own distance. You know, there are sprinters, there are middle distance runners, there are half marathoners, marathoners, and you have to know your distance. So, you know, I like writing books. This is my sixth, and you know, they're all like medium-sized books that take a medium amount of time. These are like three-year projects that yield 300 pages. I can't imagine doing, you know, being Ben Moser and writing 700 pages on Sontag or you know, Hermione Lee writing 800 pages on Virginia Woolf. That's just not my distance. I don't have 10 years in me to spend with anyone except my wife and children. But I have 3 years in me for some topics. And you know, I thought for years about writing a book about Judy Blume. I loved her books when I was very young. I reread a few of them multiple times. I really felt that in some ways she paved the way for my enjoyment of adult realist fiction. You know, the fact that I really love, you know, Richard Russo and Jonathan Franzen and Philip Roth and people like that, Meg Wolitzer for sure, is, you know, Elizabeth Strout, is to some extent based on the education that I got from reading Judy's books and how to enjoy reading about the other people's interior lives. I was not a boy who loved sci-fi or fantasy, which is what they often urge on 10-year-old boys who express an interest in books. I've never made my way through Lord of the Rings or Narnia or any of those things. I really wanted realism. I wanted to read about kids my age doing things that I could plausibly do. And that was Judy Blume's métier. So I was always interested in the books. And then I wrote a piece about her that ran in the New York Times when I was 23 years old. It was one of my first published pieces. And she and I struck up a very occasional correspondence after that. And about 10 years ago, I thought, you know, she's getting toward the end of her life. I wonder if she would cooperate with a biography. And, you know, she was resistant for a while. And then at a certain point reached out to me and said I would be willing to be interviewed. And that gave me the green light to go ahead. I can't imagine having written the book if she had stonewalled me, but when right. I knew that I would at least be able to talk to her, it became a living, breathing concern.
Once you, even as you were having those conversations and going into it, were there specific things that you knew that you wanted to answer in the sense of what you wanted to get to the bottom to when it comes to the life of Judy Blume?
Not consciously. And maybe that makes me a worse writer. It's a good question. And I feel like the right answer to it would be, yes, I had these seven curiosities that I was hoping to satisfy. But I hope I went into it with an open mind. I wanted to understand her. I wanted to know something about how the life connected to the work, if it did. I don't necessarily presume that people draw on their lives when they write. There are people who have one life and then write something utterly fantastic and different and unconnected to their quotidian existence. So I didn't presume that the books were going to be autobiographical, and for the most part, they're not. I think that if I thought about it, I could have said, I'm interested in the suburban New Jersey Jewish childhood of this woman born in 1938, like learning about the wartime era and the 50s when she 40s and 50s when she grew up was really interesting to me, perhaps in the same way that I love watching Mad Men. You know, it's not just the clothes, but it's the whole world that feels so, it's so close and yet so distant. And I think the time period interested me. Like, I'm not interested in the 1910s of Edith Wharton the way I'm interested in the 1940s of Judy Blume.
You tell us in the book that she had several creative ventures before she really caught on to deciding to write books for children.
Yes. When she was young and married and her children were a little more independent and off to school and she had a little more time on her hands, she realized that she wanted a creative outlet. She tried her hand at a few things. She tried a little bit of songwriting. She tried making visual art out of felt. She would cut pieces of felt out and stitch or glue them onto backing. And she ended up selling some of those pieces on consignment at Bloomingdale's for a while. And then she turned to writing. Her early attempts were very heavily Dr. Seuss influenced. She did the illustrations. There are these manuscripts in her archive that show her early works, never published. They are for very little kids. They rhyme. They have illustrations. They're basically, you know, cut rate Dr. Seuss. And I think she would say the same. She was not going to succeed in his world. And then she got a brochure in the mail from her alma mater, New York University, inviting alumni to take classes at NYU Night School, to return to school as adult learners. And she signed up for one of the classes, which met one night a week. And it was a class on writing for children, taught by a woman who had published a number of novels for young people. And Judy started going and I think fell in love with that particular genre and that age group to write for. And the early chapters turned into what became Iggy's House, which was her first published book. So it was not an obvious thing to her that her creative outlet was going to be writing. She is not someone who had aspired to be a writer as a young child, which did surprise me. I always figure that writers have a bit more of a writing urge than she did. And yet here she is.
And then with what she ultimately became so well known for is tackling subjects that weren't being tackled in other children's literature, throughout children's literature. And so whether she was talking about divorce or menstruation or masturbation or wet dreams or the like, this was something that she started to address in her fiction. It was certainly being addressed in adult fiction, but to have it brought into children's literature was really unheard of at the time.
I wouldn't say totally unheard of. She was a pioneer for sure, and I think you said that very well, that it was being addressed in adult fiction. And look, one of the points I make in the book is it's not like there hadn't been sex or menstruation or abortion or anything in adult literature. She was reading, you know, John O'Hara and Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald and Faulkner and all these people who dealt with, you know, alcoholism and rape and, you name it, masturbation, menstruation. I mean, everything was there in adult literature.
Yes.
Going back, you know, and you can find these themes in Shakespeare. You can find them in Homer. I mean, they aren't new themes, but putting them in children's realism felt very new. She was in a moment when a lot of children's literature was getting more realistic and more frank. So, you know, she's coming at exactly the same moment that S.E. Hinton is writing her great, you know, tetralogy of her quartet of The Outsiders, and That Was Then, This Is Now, Tex, and Rumblefish, all classics. And she's writing those in, you know, I think starting in 68 or 69 through the mid-70s. So there are other people doing it, but Judy was one of a few, and she was doing extremely well. And she, you know, ended up, as much as anyone, transforming the field.
You also talk about how much those stories and of the families and of the situation were very much drawn on her childhood, on her upbringing.
To some extent, some of them very much so. So something like starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, which is set in Miami Beach just after World War II, very heavily autobiographical. Her brother, her older brother, David, in real life had a kidney infection. And this was back in the days when they would say, go to a warmer climate, you'll heal better. You know, I don't think anyone decamps for a warmer climate anymore because of their ailments. But back then there was a lot of that. So her family, her mother and grandmother, and she and her brother all moved to Miami Beach for a couple years. Her father would fly down on weekends. He had his dental practice back in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And this was right after World War II. And one of the plot points is, you know, this young girl who just moved to Miami Beach thinks that she spots Adolf Hitler everywhere, thinks that Hitler somehow escaped and moved to Miami and is now haunting park benches in Florida. And that was based on certain fears that she had in her own life. She was kind of war haunted. And they did, in fact, go to Miami Beach. And a lot of that is true. A book like Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is interesting because it took some scenes from her childhood, like the exercises that they would, that she and her little group of four friends would do to try to increase their bust size.
Mm-hmm.
But it moved them into 1970, which was, you know, Judy's daughter's generation. You know, Judy's memories were of four girls doing this in, you know, the late 1940s. She was born in 1938. So, you know, 1948, 1949, 1950. But the scenes that we have in our mind from the book and now from the very good movie that was made of the book a couple years ago are scenes set in, you know, the Nixon era, are set in the oranges and browns and big gas-guzzling cars of 1970, not 1950. So that's one that, in a sense, has some autobiography in it, but actually is portraying a totally different world.
When you talked to her and interviewed her and asked the questions that you wanted to ask, what were those conversations like? And were you getting what you wanted in the sense of getting a sense of why she was writing what she was writing and the impact it was having?
I think those conversations were as rewarding as they could have been. I think with most writers, you bump up pretty quickly against the fact that they don't always know why they're choosing their topics. Sometimes right. Their topics find them. And that they, to some extent, write in a fugue state or on autopilot where, you know, when it's over, they can't remember why they made the choices they made along the way. And there is a kind of innocence and naivete about one's own creative journey that I think writers and other artists have. So they aren't always the best explainers of the choices they made. Writers are probably better than other kinds of artists. I mean, I always say if you really want a terrible interview, you know, ask a rock star about, you know, how they play guitar, or ask a dancer about their dancing, or, you know, like, because when you they can be geniuses, but their genius is not for explaining things in words. Their genius is for movement as a dancer, or sculpting as a sculptor, or woodworking. And then saying, talk to me about it. Well, talking isn't what they know how to do. They're no better at talking about sculpture than I am at sculpting about words. So it's really fruitless and hopeless with most artists. With writers, they're at least in the game. You know, they you ask them, explain this, use your words to explain to me this choice you made. Well, they know how to use words, but they still can often be pretty clueless or forgetful about why they made certain choices in the moment. So I would say that I don't have great insight. I don't have the kind of great insight I would have wanted into, you know, why certain dialogue popped up in certain places, or why did you choose to make this character, you know, tall and this one short? And I didn't ask a lot of those questions. And if I did, I'm not sure that Judy had great answers. So I think to some extent, the creative process, as much as I tried to demystify it, probably still remains a little mysterious, as it has to. But I asked her about lots of things. I asked her about her childhood, her marriages, her health, her education, her relatives. And she was extremely forthcoming pretty much all the time. I really can't think of many instances where she said, I'd prefer not to talk about that, or where she obfuscated. The great example, if there is one, would be her second husband, who she did not want to talk about and has never wanted to talk about. She just didn't. It wasn't a good marriage. It was fairly brief, and it was sandwiched between a fairly long, meaningful first marriage that ended, but that gave her two children, and a very, very successful third marriage that's been over 45 years now, or they've been together over 45 years. So the second marriage was something that she, I think, would have preferred not to talk about as much as I insisted she talk about it.
In those questions in learning about her life, learning about her marriages, learning about, as we said, the childhood, you get a picture. The times I've interviewed her, the thing that she seems to be the most interested in talking about and is the most eloquent in talking about is a legacy that she has and how kids and how readers have responded to the work that she's put out in the world.
Definitely. She's aware of her legacy and she's cultivated it. And I think she's done a lot of she's been a great citizen of the literary community. You know, she's spoken out against people who would try to curtail what children can read and would try to use government power to intervene on choices that should rightfully belong to children and maybe their parents and teachers, but probably not the government. She is a great ambassador for other people's books. I tell a couple stories in my book about ways that she stepped up to help other writers who were having trouble finding a publisher or had received bad press and needed some help. She's an ally. She sees herself as a citizen of the literary world and wants to do it well.
When you were interviewing her, you did a series of interviews and then you presented her with a draft and it took some time, but she did respond to it. But then after that, the communication went away, if I have that right.
More or less. I mean, yes, I interviewed her. I interviewed dozens and dozens of other people.
Sure.
I read through 130 boxes of her archived correspondence. I wrote a draft. And then, yes, I did show it to her, as I always had said I would. And that had been something we'd agreed to because I wanted her feedback. It was also always clear that the book was my project and that the editorial choices would be mine. So there were, she caught some errors and she suggested various changes and I fixed the errors. And some of her advice I thought was good and made the book better. And some of it I didn't take because it's ultimately, my project and the buck stops with me. I have to stand behind it. And then she continued to respond to, she did respond to several, at least a couple more rounds of fact-checking queries. And, I think the book has benefited tremendously from her willingness to talk to me.
But am I right in that she never read the final product?
I actually don't know. I mean, so the final product comes along pretty late in the game, right? You're continuing to make changes. I think there were a couple interviews that came through very late. I'm incorporating, corrections that she's suggested, but also ones that my editor suggested and my wife and a couple of my daughters read the book. And so I'm up until the last possible moment, I'm tinkering with things. And finally the publisher says, okay, enough. You can't make any more changes. We have to move to typesetting and all that. And, so the final book is, has always changed from what it was in previous iterations. And I have no idea if she's read the book that you find on your bookshelves. What I know is that she read, a draft of it, a polished draft, but by no means the final one, and offered notes that ended up being totally invaluable and really, really helpful.
But do you have a sense of why communication broke off? I mean, do you think that was done? I mean, it's impossible to know, of course, but it just seems that given her hesitancy and unwillingness to write a memoir herself, that as you're doing it, that there may have just been a cooling period as to the idea of putting her life out there.
I mean, I think that's an intriguing idea. What I will say is even as you ask that, I want to be clear, I never put words in Judy's mouth.
Sure.
I'm not going to do it now, and I didn't do it in the book. I quoted her when I had on the record useful stuff to quote, and the book is completely suffused with her voice, and not just from my interviews with her, but from hundreds of interviews she's done over the years, right? I had, of course, decades worth of good reporting and good interviews done by other people and the transcripts of them. So it's completely suffused with her, with her voice. And yet she never did decide to write a memoir. She asked me to write her biography. In 2022, she approached me and said, let's talk. And ultimately what came of that was her willingness to be interviewed and to make her husband and children and some friends available for interviews. How she feels about that decision now, or whether she thinks it would have been better if she'd written a book about her own life herself, I just can't say. That would be for her to say.
And it seems, in my reading, it is a beautiful, it's a fascinating story. And your love for her, your interest in her comes through. And I think that is a lovely part of it.
I can't imagine writing a book about someone whom I didn't admire and feel warmth toward. I wouldn't want to spend that much time with their inner life, with their papers, with their, you know, with profiles of them, with them. So I'm glad you say that. I do think look, no credit to me. It's a fascinating life. It's a life that began in pre-war, you know, small town New Jersey and went through, you know, World War II and all the subsequent wars, went through the feminist revolution, went through the civil rights movement, went through huge changes in the publishing industry, you know, and she is somebody who openly has said she has benefited from sort of pro-choice laws. She is somebody who's benefited from the ability of women to make choices about divorce, whether or not they stay in their marriage. You know, she's on her third marriage. She has benefited from so many liberalizing changes in society. And I think that the literature also in some fairly, you know, perhaps in indirect ways reflects that journey that America has been on. So what I loved about it was I realized pretty quickly that this book about her was really a book about all of us and about the country. I mean, she's 88, so she's lived a century of our country's life.
One of the things I'll end here, but one of the things that I think is fascinating too is because she's talking about the topic she's talking about in so many of the very popular books, that she gets that reputation for that's what she's writing about. And I think often forgotten in there is the fact that she's a damn good writer. The material in her adult books, but in her children's books as well, it's really good. And I think you bring that out in your biography of it can be overlooked of just what an outstanding writer she is.
Look, and it's so good of you to say that. And this is something that I think all people who write either specific genres, sci-fi, fantasy, crime, romance, whatever, they suffer from this, you know, underestimating the underestimation. And people who write for children, and often women who write for children, really suffer from being seen as providing an almost like commodity for young people, as if they were selling them candy or, you know, superhero right. toys, action figures. And they can get overlooked as literary artists. And, you know, her books would not last the way they have if not for the real literary merit in them. And I do hope that comes out in the biography.
The name of the book is Judy Blume, A Life. It is published by Putnam. Mark Oppenheimer will be at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on Tuesday, the 24th of March at 7 p.m. And he'll be talking about and signing the new book. Mark, a delight to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Be well. Take care. Again, Mark Oppenheimer will be at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on the 24th of March. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. The name of the book is Judy Blume, A Life. It is published by Putnam. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.